this industry, though, is changing. It's changing dramatically. It's changing fast. And what I want you to keep in mind is today, over 50% of Americans are not one, not two, but are three generations removed from agriculture. That means they're not from a farm. They weren't raised on a farm, okay? And their grandparents didn't have a farm, okay? So we're living this illusion sometimes that the world we think we're living in is a John Wayne world, okay? And if you'd flip up John Wayne there for me, a little story if you don't believe me on this. So as we're prepping these slides, I asked my brilliant daughters, and my daughters are brilliant, I said, I need a picture of John Wayne for my presentation. What do you think their response was? Who is John Wayne? Guys, if you're thinking we're living in this atmosphere where ropes and trees solve problems, we aren't. The John Wayne world is behind us, okay? And now the scary part, guys, and this should be scary to you. I asked those same daughters, I said, if it's not a John Wayne world, I want to see a picture of what kind of world you think it is today. Are you concerned yet? Are you a little bit nervous? Anybody know who that is? No, that's my daughter's boyfriend. No, that's Justin Bieber. That's Justin Bieber. And so it's more of this Justin Bieber world, okay? And a Justin Bieber world is a much different world than a John Wayne world. And we've got to adapt to that. Because the one thing I want to point out is when you're three generations removed from agriculture, okay, and you're in a Justin Bieber world, where does your food come from? The grocery store, right? It comes from, they have no idea. And this is the part, the lead up into who we're going to talk to is, and if they are three generations removed from ag, where does their knowledge about us come from? Next slide. Yellowstone. Don't kid yourself because I have evidence, okay? I happen to fly around a lot in an airplane, and I used to always wear my hat, right? And you know when you fly in an airplane and you wear a hat, the person next to you gets to ask you questions, right? That's just the way it works. And the first question, especially about 2 years ago, that they always asked was what? Are you from Texas? And you should see the responses when I said I was from Minnesota. Several of them argued with me that cows weren't in Minnesota, okay? But over the last couple of years, though, and this is the impact of Yellowstone, okay? Where did they start to ask where I was from? Montana. And before we go to Taylor Sheridan, I'm going to tell you what the next question they usually ask me is. Are you ready? Do you have a train station? With Lattice, welcome to the screen, Mr. Taylor Sheridan. Well, Taylor, for a little bit of background, Taylor, and thanks for being here. I know you've had to adjust your schedule. We're going on the fly here as well. But Taylor, guys, he's an Academy Award nominated writer behind the hit series Yellowstone that we just talked about. It's critically acclaimed 1883 prequel and all in the hit series Mayor of Kingstown. He's a Texas native. By the way, my wife's a Texas native. He excels in Western horse performance industry, is an avid supporter and competitor in reining and cutting. He owns and operates not one but two ranches in his home state of Texas. One is the very famous historical Four Sixes Ranch, headquartered in Guthrie, and of course, Bosque Ranch in Weatherford, Texas. And unfortunately, that's where he is right now, snowed in. Taylor, welcome to our event.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm sorry I couldn't be there in person. We got an ice storm. It's icing right now. And you know, you run enough cattle, you don't complain about the form your moisture comes in. You just say thank you. So I'll take it. However God gives it, he sends it in blocks of ice from the sky. I'm just going to say thank you.
Well, we're glad to have you. I was just speaking outside with Joe Leathers as the way you're a ranch manager, so we're glad you're safe and glad you're there. As I mentioned, Yellowstone has taken the country by storm and put the American cowboy front and center. What is it about our industry that makes a good background for your creative filmmaking?
Well, you know, and I'm going to have to back up a little bit and talk about something that you mentioned, because it's what inspired me to write Yellowstone in the first place. I was reading an article in a newspaper out in California when I'd first moved there, and some cheerleader up in Northern California had gone deer hunting and shot this big deer, and the picture made its way into the news and made its way into a San Francisco newspaper, and I was reading the letters to the editor where they were saying some pretty horrible things about this girl, and one of the people wrote in and said that the girl should be killed. Oh, and why can't she go to the grocery store and get her food where it's made? and people, so when you say it, it's not semantics. There are people who, if you are three or four generations in a large urban area, you don't have any idea where your food comes from. And your notion of where it comes from is influenced solely by whoever tells you where it comes from, and chances are they don't know either. So that's that motivated me to realize, and I was raised in the country. My family's been there. I'm sixth generation Texan, and on one side were mostly law enforcement that ran small ranches that supplemented income with cattle and sheep and whatever else, horses. And then on the other side in West Texas, out around Stanford, they were cotton farmers and cattle ranchers on a much larger scale. So I was involved in both and saw both. Most ranches actually produce 30 head or less, as you know, the bulk. There aren't many ranches at the scope of a 4.6s or a Wagner or a Pitchfork down in Texas or even up in Wyoming. Those are the exception, not the rule. The rule is it's a lifestyle that's been passed down, and probably that land has been whittled from a much larger tract to a smaller tract because of inheritance tax and property tax, et cetera, et cetera. And yet they still cling to that notion, which is what my parents did, which is it's a lifestyle that teaches countless lessons, and you are providing for yourself and others. And that's been lost in large urban areas, which is where decisions are made politically. And so with Yellowstone, I decided to tell the story of the West. I'd spent quite a bit of time in Wyoming, and it's got very unique conflicts taking place there surrounding the cattle industry. And I looked at those as metaphors for problems that were happening throughout America and rural America. And I had a goal, which was, number one, I'll put some drama and sugar on the pill, but I'm going to teach you a little bit about where your food comes from and the effort it takes to raise it. And then number two, because at the end of the day, what most of these kids, and the kids are the influencers, I say kids, the 20-somethings wandering around LA and New York and San Francisco trying to find a job or get one, trying to be as intellectually present and hip and cool as they possibly can be, they cling to whatever the cool kid says that's cool. And so if it's cool to be vegan, even though there's no real health benefit to it and you're not saving any lives by doing it, but then that's what we say. Okay, well, I'm going to make it cool to be cowboy. And so that was the goal that I set out to do, is revitalize the industry. It's why I reached out to my friends from that world, and I stuck on performance horses. I didn't go out to Wrangler, not that there's anything wrong with Wrangler, but I went to small, independently owned, the bootmakers, the Rios of Mercedes and Anderson Bean, and it's Kimes Ranch, and I knew that guy when he was selling his jeans out of the back of a pickup truck at horse shows. And I, you know, the saddles are handmade saddles from, you know, whether it's a Bob Marsh saddle or it's Andy Maschke making one or an Oliver, the bits are Clapper and Kerry Kelly and the ones that people use. And I wanted it to be real and authentic, and I wanted cowboys to watch it and go, that's about as good as you're going to be able to do it with a bunch of actors. And I knew that if I could convince people in the cattle producing business, in agriculture, to watch it and watch an entertaining version of real issues they're dealing with, then I could get everybody to watch it. And I was speaking at this deal in December, and I said, look, there's a boot barn on Sunset Boulevard in West Hollywood. and I put it there. So now I got them thinking it's cool. Okay, great. So now let's explain to them, hey, here's where your food comes from. You got questions about the cattle industry, ask away.
Very good. Excellent, excellent answer. Appreciate that. And Taylor, having watched the show myself and enjoyed it immensely, I'm telling you, you exactly hit the right stride. The way you weave those issues into the storylines, I mean, it makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. It is a masterful job. And on behalf of the beef industry, I want to just tell you directly, thank you for the job you're doing that way.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it. And to have you say it, I mean, that's why I did it. So it means a lot.
You shoot the ranch scenes on the Chief Joseph Ranch, which is a working ranch. Does the shooting ever interfere with ranch operations, or how does that work?
Well, Chief Joseph at one time was the largest dairy in Montana. And it's called Chief Joseph because the lodge there was built in 1914 where Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce had camped at one point. And it was an apple orchard at one point. And at this point, the gentleman who owns it, he'll lease it out and run some cattle. But oddly, it's not a terribly large ranch. It just backs up to National Forest, so it looks really large.
Gotcha.
So all the ranching done on that is you know, the cattle we get, there's a rancher that lives up the hill, and we'll bring his cattle down, and they'll come down and push them down with us. And we use those cattle primarily for the show. And then there's some ranchers in the Big Hole Valley, not too far away. And when we've got a big scene where we're bringing in, there's a few scenes where we had 600 pairs, we brought those over from the Big Hole.
Wow. Very cool. Switching gears just a little bit. And as you know, the Four Sixes is such an historic ranch. I mean, everybody's talking about it, et cetera. But the country went abuzz when you purchased the Four Sixes ranches. What motivated you to do that, and what do you hope to achieve with that storied ranch?
Well, that's a longer conversation, but I guess we're here to have it. So, so season 3 of Yellowstone had ended, and Yellowstone was the biggest show on TV, the biggest dramatic series on cable, numbers rivaling NFL football games. And I saw some piece on some news deal saying Yellowstone, the most famous ranch in America. And when they said that, it really worried me, because I knew someday in the next 3 or 4 or 5 years, that show's going to be over. And I didn't want cowboy to be a trend. And it's a fake ranch. The Yellowstone doesn't exist.
Gotcha.
So I said, look, the show's as popular as it's ever going to be, which turned out to not be the case. It keeps getting more popular. I'm going to spend season 4 on an actual working ranch. I'm going to show, forgetting, there's going to be no train station. There's going to be no, I'm just going to show what it's like to be on an actual working ranch and show the beauty of it, the romance of it, because it is romantic. I've never got up before sunrise and ridden out to gather and brand and not thought, my gosh, I can't believe I get to do this. Even though when I was 16, I was in the same situation, and I'd go, my God, I can't believe it. I have to do this. But now it's get to. Used to be have to, now it's get to. So I called a buddy of mine named Randy Bloomer, who makes the trailers, and I'd met Doc Blodgett a few times, but I didn't know him that well, and I didn't want to go alone. I said, look, if you grow up where I grew up in Texas, then the Four Sixes is, you're standing in the shadow of the Sixes. Had I grown up around Houston, I might say the King, but in if you're around Fort Worth, which I was, then you're going to say the Four Sixes Ranch. So I drove out to Guthrie, and I sat down with Doc Blodgett and Joe Leathers and said, look, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to tell the story of the Four Sixes and just tell a story of ranching and watch some kid become a man on this ranch. And Joe let me have it with both barrels. And he said, you Hollywood son of a gun, I'm not about to let you come in here with this immoral, this and that. You need to get out of here as fast as you can do it. And I'm like, Joe, wait, I'm on your side. You need to watch the show. If you'll watch the show, you'll see I'm actually trying to support this way of life. I'm not attacking it. And I'm not asking your permission to do this. I'm just asking your permission to do it here. I can go next door to the Pitchfork and make that the most famous ranch if that's what you'd prefer. And he huffed off, and I turned to Doc and I said, "Doc, please just watch the show and then call me back and you'll see." And Doc said, "Oh, I've seen every episode." It just had the good cop, bad cop me a little. So then it worked its way up the flagpole to Miss Marion, who owns the ranch. And Miss Marion called me and said, "Taylor, I understand you want to film out there." And I said, "Yes, ma'am, I do." And she said, "Is there going to be any violence in the scenes?" And I said, "No, ma'am, none." "Is there going to be any sex?" And I said, "Well, here, look, a cowboy's going to fall in love with a vet tech, and that's probably happening right now." And I am gonna masturbate one stallion, but I'll let you choose the stallion. And she laughed and said, "Oh, Taylor, okay." So she allowed me to film out there. About 3 months later, she passed away. And Neil Zagather, who was the trustee out there, he honored her permission and was still allowing me to come film. And so we're driving from Montana, where we've been filming, out to Dixon Creek, and I get a phone call that the will's been read, and Miss Marion had asked that the ranch be sold. And there's three divisions, for those who don't know. One is in Guthrie, one is about 3 hours away in north of Amarillo. It's called Dixon Creek. And then there's a third division about an hour from there, a little less, called Frisco Creek, which is a backgrounding yard. And we all knew that what was most likely going to happen is that this ranch was going to be broken up, and that would be the end of it. And I called the head of the studio, actually, and said, "Look, I'm driving out to the Sixes right now to go film the story of a real ranch. And by the time it airs, this ranch will not exist." And I called my wife and I said, "Look, I don't know what to do, because the ranch I'm going to go film, they're about to break up." Then I get a phone call from a realtor who says, "Hey, we've been speaking with the seller's realtor, and it's Miss Marion's hopes that she can find someone that will continue her vision, and she'd like to try and do that prior to taking it out on the market. And we all think that that person is you." And I said, "How much is the ranch?" And they said, it's $350 million. And I said, "Well, I'm about 330 short. So I'm going to need a minute. Give me a few days. Don't do anything. Give me a few days." So I called my wife and I said, "Look, there's want tos in this life and there's have tos. And I think I have to do this, because I'm afraid if I don't, it won't exist. It's lasted 152 years, 150 years at that point. And if I don't do this, it will not exist. And I think that I can get it to go another 150. But it's going to change. My plan was to retire. I'd already bought Bosque Ranch. My plan was to retire and just run these movie horses and show horses, and I was good. I said, "It's going to change that. I'm going to have to go to the network and make a big overall deal with them and write a whole bunch of TV shows for them in order to pull this off. So I need to know you're on board, because it changes the plan." And then I had a conversation with my son, who's now 12. He was 10 at the time. And I said, "Look, this changes the plan for you too, because if I'm real lucky, I got 35 years in. And then what? So you've got to want to do this too. This changes what you do for a living. Because whether you like it or not, you're a rancher." And he cried and said, "Okay, I'll do it." I said, "All right." So I went and made the overall deal. I reached out to some investors to get some minority investors, as much to help me offset the cost as bring in some really fresh ideas. So I brought in investors that have experience in oil and gas. I brought in investors that have experience in hospitality. And I brought in actually the studio, because there's nothing better than a movie company showing up and filming for about a month and paying you a bunch of money and then leaving. It's about the greatest deal going. So we got the ranch bought, and I had a conversation with Joe Leathers, where he said, "What's your vision for this ranch?" And I explained it. I said, we can improve the horse. It's a very storied place with fantastic ranch horses, but we can improve that. We can really pursue some of these big stallions, and we can improve that, and we can improve the general herd of ranch horses throughout that region. You know, we bred 1,800 mares last year, and so that's having a tremendous impact upon ranching and on the quarter horse. And then I said, I want to take this whole herd straight to the plate. I want to go direct to consumer and direct to food service. And that is something that Joe Leathers and Miss Marion have been trying to work out for 20 years. And as she got ill, she wasn't able to pursue that anymore. And so his vision for the ranch aligned perfectly with mine, which is how I was fortunately able to keep the leadership in place, which I needed, and keep the ranch intact with the same employees as it's had for so long. So that's a long-winded answer of how I became. And I'll tell you what, there was a period, because it was a foot race to close this deal with Paramount and then finance the ranch. And I'll tell you what, I was really rich for about 45 minutes. It happened on the same day. And so I closed one deal, and I became a pass-through corporation and funded the ranch, and now I'm broke again.
Well, thank you, Taylor. The other thing we're kind of curious about, and I know you've seen kind of both sides. You've got the Hollywood people that you kind of got a relationship with, a vision with. Given that, are you optimistic about the future of ranching?
Well, I am, because I think that, like I said earlier, and I'm going to tell you what, I happen to think that COVID, as big a tragedy as it was, and it affected a lot of people, it was very good for agriculture in this way, because we learned all of a sudden that we're beholden to the supply chain, and it was a national or international supply chain. And when all of a sudden the grocery stores were out of food, a lot of people started going online and looking for, where do I get food? And they found different ranches, R.A. Brown Ranch, not far from me, being one of them, where you can go buy beef. They started to find local purveyors that did not have the supply chain issues. They were able to buy seafood directly off of ships in Alaska and get it sent to them. They were able to order a box weekly or monthly of eggs and vegetables and fruits from local farmers. That were aggressive enough and visionary enough to put that out there. The internet is a great equalizer for people to be able to go, hey, here's my product. And so I thought it educated people. It's an education that they didn't want when us as an industry tried to put it out there. But it's an education that they got. And the increase that we've seen in people trying to actually source where their food comes from. And then the thing that I try to do on Yellowstone is educate people. And I go back to my childhood. I remember sitting in my grandfather's lap in this old Ford tractor plowing our wheat pasture and realizing, good gosh, Grandpa, we're sure killing a lot of stuff. I mean, every snake, a little rabbit, and these quail can't get out of the way. And man, this plows, this thing's a disaster to the little ecosystem we're going over. And he goes, well, son, we're animals. And there's not an animal on this planet that survival isn't at the expense of another animal on this planet. Whether it's the mesquite tree growing wide to sit there and capture all the sunlight and all the moisture to get it to its roots that prevents things from growing underneath it. Everything is in competition. So as I said in Yellowstone, when I pointed that out in season 4, where I said, look, when you plow a field, you kill everything in the field. And you limit what's going to come back in the field. So the question becomes, how cute does an animal have to be before you think it deserves to live? And that's not logical. That's emotional. And that's ignorance. So through education and saying, look, if you don't want to, if you have an issue with your stomach and you can't eat this or that, and you've got a restricted diet, I fully understand. But if you think you're somehow ethically or morally superior because you don't eat beef or chicken, or then you're woefully misguided. So for me to continue to educate and try to, and I did it with 1883. People don't recognize that, but we have a We have a narrative in this nation that everyone that moved west were these warmongering people that were sent out to assimilate and destroy. But that's not the case. The people who moved west, who came here, whether it's from Europe or whether they came from Kentucky, they had completely failed. They had absolutely nothing. And so they went west and faced that risk and danger, my family included, which came from Kentucky. And they risked all of that because they were not going to survive where they were, or they weren't willing to survive under those conditions. So you can question whether or not they should have been told in some newspaper ad in Bulgaria or Sweden or Norway or Great Britain, hey, free land, come on. They didn't mention that there were Native Americans there. Okay, you can question the government for that, but you can't question the tenacity of the desperate individual who brought his family and risked his and their lives, many of whom were lost, to go try and seek that better life.
Well said. Hey, you have a whole room full of fellow cattle producers here. Any advice for them collectively that you said, you know, as I've seen the world, here's the advice. What is it, Taylor?
I'm a massive believer in education. We live in a really polarized time right now where everyone's doing a whole lot of talking and they're not doing a whole bunch of listening. And we're seeing politically motivated science, if we can call it that. And one of my favorites is that that these cattle are going to belch us out of existence. Ozone layer. It's not going to be the clear cutting of the forest in Brazil with all these diesel bulldozers with no muffler on them. No, it's going to be that belching cow is going to do us in. It's preposterous. And they talk about, you know, cattle grazing on this land that could otherwise be used to grow crops. Not true. Cattle grazing is a terrible way to farm grass, as we all know. It's an excellent way to farm grass in marginal grassland areas, in areas where you can't farm, in rocky soil, in places that are too steep, because cattle are pretty hardy. They can get up those mountains in Wyoming and get to grass that would have been grazed by any number of other things that we didn't extirpate. Because if it wasn't for cattle being running around up there, then there'd be buffalo up there, or there'd be more elk or something else. Grass is meant to be eaten. It stimulates the growth. So cattle's an extremely efficient way to graze in the area where I graze, in that rocky country where you can't grow anything in West Texas. Okay, but if you go out to where Dixon Creek is, you're going to see lots of really flat ground with good irrigation where they're going to grow the crop that makes them the most money, and that is going to be cotton, it's going to be whatever it's going to be. But you get over in that sandy ground that I've got with rolling hills that you can't plow and you can't grow anything, cattle is the most efficient way to graze that. It's the most efficient way to harvest that grass. So, and I think when you point these things out, there's really no argument. And I think that people need to understand, okay, so beef, I don't eat beef. I don't have beef anywhere in my life. Not true. That's not true. You can think it's true, but it's not true. What do you think is in your makeup? Are you taking blood pressure medication? Where do you think that came from? Are you taking blood thinners? Are you taking this? There's 60-something antibiotics and pharmaceuticals that come just from the blood of a cow or a steer. So I think we have to educate the world that's willing to listen and say, guys, something's getting harvested. We're either going to take an area and we're going to plant a bunch of grain or whatever the case may be and feed that or use that as a fuel or whatever. Or we can go out to these marginal areas where we can't do that and we can raise cattle and we can feed a whole lot of people and we can do a lot of stuff. We can clothe people. We can make all sorts of byproducts. We can make medicines. We can do all these things.
Well, thank you both so much. What an incredible interview. What a great interview. Taylor Sheridan, thank you so much. Thank you.